Hey guys, it's Albert. We're locked and loaded and steamrolling towards week six. We're going to kick things off with my takeaways. We've got a great guest for you this week. And as always, I get to your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. All right, welcome back in. Week five is in the books. We're nearly a third of the way through the season. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We've got a great guest lined up for you this week. We are going to get to your questions, but as we always do, we'll start with my five takeaways from the weekend. And I'm going to begin right there on Monday night with what we all just witnessed, the San Francisco 49ers putting a beat down on the Cleveland Browns. We will get to Baker and the Browns, but the first thing I want to hit here is the San Francisco 49ers and how this does not look like a Cinderella. This does not look like a team that's just this does not look like a team that's doing it with smoke and mirrors. They're fast, they're well coached, and look, bottom line, they're talented. And I think in a lot of ways the team that we're seeing right now is the team so many people expected to see last year. And if you talk to Kyle Shanahan or John Lynch, last year they would have been like, tap the brakes, we're not quite there yet. I think they're pretty close now to being where they've planned to be over the last couple of years in building that team up. The two things that stick out, first of all, the line play. The offensive line, again, I mean, you look at the numbers, they rushed for 275 yards, 6.9 yards per carry. That's a result of investing back into the offensive line. Weston Richburg's made a big difference. Mike McGlinchey, their first-round pick from 2018, he's helped. And I think having Joe Staley coming back later in the year, that's going to help too. And then look at what they're doing on the other side of the ball. Nick Bosa looked like a superstar on Monday night. DeForest Buckner, I think, is playing at an all-pro level. You've got other former first-round picks like Dee Ford, like Eric Armstead, like Solomon Thomas in that group. If you're strong on the lines of scrimmage, you're going to be in it every week. That's the way it works in the NFL. And they've invested a ton of capital into those two groups. They've invested money into Joe Staley and Weston Richburg. They invested a top 10 pick into Mike McGlinchey, and they've invested four first round picks and a big free agent contract, and plus a draft pick for a fifth defensive lineman. So to me, I look at that team. That team's full of talent. They're fast. They're well coached. I think what you saw is real, and what you saw is what a lot of people expected to see in 2018 when the Niners quarterback got hurt. And when the rest of the roster wasn't quite there yet. Okay, number two, Baker and the Browns. I think there's some reality to what we saw there too. Again, I think Freddie Kitchens is going to find a way to keep the team together through this. But that offensive line continues to look like a fatal flaw. And again, I think that this goes back to how you build a football team and how all of us on the outside obsess over the shiny weapons, the shiny skill position players. And this is still a game that's won in the trenches. And here's what I want to highlight. It was way more relevant on Monday night that the Browns were bad at tackle than it was that they're good at receiver. How bad Greg Robinson was had more of an effect on the game than how good Odell Beckham is. And that's just football. And I don't know how they go about fixing this offensive line issue on the fly, but it's something you can see coming going into the year. It's something that's led to some regression from their quarterback. And you look at where they are from a depth standpoint. And the interesting thing about Monday night to me was you wonder if maybe they're in that same spot the Niners were last year, where they finished the previous year real strong, but they hadn't quite gotten the roster exactly where they wanted it. But they had some exciting things going on, so everybody on the outside got all excited, and they went through some predictable bumps. Now, obviously, again, Jimmy Garoppolo getting hurt brings another element into it in the San Francisco example from 2018, but I think that this may be where we're looking at the Browns as something that's fully formed right now, and you look at the offensive line issue, you look at some of the discipline issues, you look at the depth issue on defense, particularly at corner with Denzel Ward and Greedy Williams banged up. Maybe all along they were really just a year away. Another year of acquisitions on the veteran market, another year of draft picks, maybe just a year away from where they want to be. And again, that offensive line issue isn't going away. Okay, number three. The Washington Redskins fired Jay Gruden, came as a surprise to nobody after they fell to 0-5, losing to the New England Patriots at home in a game at FedEx Field that was a really bad look for the franchise. I've talked to people who were there in the building who said it was 75-80% Patriots fans. It was clear in the parking lot. Guy I know told me that out there in the parking lot, there were actually Redskins fans soliciting Patriots fans to participate in a sell the team chant. Crazy stuff going on at FedEx Field. And so this is rock bottom. And I'm not convinced they're going to be able to find their way out of it in the short term. And it's not even about where the roster is. It's about accountability. And the one thing I appreciate about Jay Gruden, he was accountable to all of this. He knew this could happen. When I talked to him over the summer, he said, if I don't win, I know I'm gone. So he's accountable for everything that happened there. I think the players, to some degree, I think the players have been accountable. Upper management has not been accountable. That press conference, that Bruce Allen press conference on Monday, you didn't get a hint that he felt like he or Dan Snyder were responsible in any way for how sideways the franchise has gone. And if you're another coach who has options, would that really be where you want to take your shot? Now, I know there are only 32 of them, and $5, $6, $7, $8 million a year is nothing to scoff at. But is that really where you would want to take your shot? Would be with the Redskins, with Dan Snyder, with Bruce Allen, based on what's happened? Again, they're going to find somebody. But if you're Lincoln Riley, or you're Matt Rhule, or you're one of these big names at the college level, or you're Josh McDaniels, and you've waited like almost a decade to take your second chance at it, would you roll the dice with those guys? I think they're going to have a problem finding anybody with options who's willing to take that job. Number four, I had the most impressive performance of the weekend, the Indianapolis Colts. They continue to get it done. Again, I'm not saying they're world beaters, but right now they're 3-2. They went to Arrowhead and won. Yes, Patrick Mahomes was banged up. Yes, the Chiefs were banged up on the defensive line. They were missing Sammy Watkins. They were missing Tyreek Hill. So, yes, there were issues there. But, again, I think this boils down to how you build a team. And you look at the Colts, they've invested in the defensive line. They've invested in the offensive line. You look at the veterans they put on that D-line, Danico Autry and Justin Houston, and the guys they've drafted onto that D-line, guys like Tyquan Lewis and Kamiko Touré, who got hurt the other night. And then on the offensive line, you look at what they've done to fix that group with Quentin Nelson and Braden Smith. And, you know, obviously, the holdovers, Ryan Kelly and Anthony Costanzo, they're strong through the lines of scrimmage. They're built in a way where they don't have to be overly reliant on the quarterback. It's one of the reasons why I said when Andrew Luck was still there, they had dynasty potential, because because Andrew Luck, for the first time in his career, was in a place where he wouldn't have to throw for 300 yards every week to win. It's a good environment for Jacoby Brissett to grow and learn. I think they're going to keep getting better. And to me, the big stat from Sunday night, 37 minutes of possession. That is a staggering number. They rushed for 180 yards. They held the Chiefs to 36 yards rushing. They held the Chiefs to 4 possessions in the second half. That's not just about putting good players in your team. That's about having a vision for how you build the team. And that's about knowing what it takes to win in the NFL and being able to go into that sort of environment and play the game on your terms, which you can do, again, as we saw again on Monday night, if you build through the lines of scrimmage. Okay, number five, this is going to be the last thing before we get to our very special guest this week. Trade deadline is about 3 weeks away, and I think we're going to again see an active market, so I want to give you guys an update on a couple things. Number one, I think my sense is that ownership has gotten more and more involved in the Jalen Ramsey situation in Jacksonville. They were asking for 2 first-round picks, or a first-round pick, another high pick, and a player. I think at this point, from an ownership perspective, the idea looking at it like globally now is, if we're going to get him back, we better get a blockbuster package. If we're going to get him back, we better get something that either Doug Marrone and Tom Coughlin can build off of, or whoever here is next can. Otherwise, it makes sense for the owner to sit there and say, well, this is an elite all-pro talent. So if I'm not sure that Tom and Doug are going to be here next year, maybe I just ride this thing out. Maybe I just let this thing go until the end of the year, and then we let our next executive vice president, our next head coach, make a decision on that. And so the Jalen Ramsey situation, I think, is sort of in a holding pattern. Everybody in the league, to varying degrees, pretty much everybody, except for maybe like Patrick Mahomes and Russell Wilson, is available. I think the price is going to be awfully high, as we've established all along. A couple other teams, I think that I can tell you that contending teams are monitoring. One's the Denver Broncos, Chris Harris, Emmanuel Sanders, Adam Gostis. Those are guys who are in contract years that I think will be trade targets for other teams. I don't think that they deal Von Miller, because Von Miller's almost like a quarterback there in, you know, the place he has in the community and the standing he has in the team and all of that different stuff. But they're certainly a team that other teams are watching, and I think that they would really have to fall out of contention for John Elway and Vic Fangio and the positions that they're in to conduct a fire sale. So really, I think the availability of those guys is going to boil down to what you've got, what the Broncos have got over the next few weeks. They win on Sunday, obviously. I think that maybe pushes the pause button on all of this. But that's one team that the contending teams are monitoring. The other, this is sort of out of nowhere now, is Atlanta. Austin Hooper, Devondre Campbell, Vic Beasley, three young players that are in contract years that I think the team's going to have a hard time re-signing. If the Falcons continue to play this way, I wouldn't be shocked if Thomas Dimitroff and the front office are fielding phone calls on those guys. So that's our five takeaways for the week. We will get to our special guest right after this. All right, we're back, and I'm going to bring in a good buddy of mine. And I think this is the third straight week we've had a former first-round pick on. He is a former first-round pick, was the 13th pick in the 2002 draft out of Tennessee. Former Saint, Eagle, Patriot, Brown, Raven, and this is why we're bringing him in. Redskin receiver Dante Stallworth. He's now a CNN contributor. Dante, what's up?
Hey, what's going on, Al? Thanks for having me, brother.
You got it, bud. All right, so let's start here. Like your first reaction when you see the news, you know, that Jay's fired. You know, obviously, you were there twice. So you were there in 11. You were there for pretty much the offseason program through training camp, right, in 13. Mm-hmm. When you saw the news, what was the first thing that ran through your head?
I was at the game. I was at the Patriots game when they came down here to play Washington. And I wasn't really expecting him to be fired after that game. I mean, I don't know if they expected to win. They played damn well in the first half. Well enough to keep the Patriots off balance, and they were able to capitalize on some mistakes that the Patriots made. But then after the game, you know, I saw the reports when I woke up in the morning that they had called in Jay Gruden at 5 a.m, and that's probably never a good thing when your employer asks you to come in a couple hours earlier than you're normally there. I guess it was expected soon. I didn't realize it would happen after the Patriots game. I honestly thought it would happen either before or after whoever they were playing this week. I figured a change was coming soon. But, you know, it just seems to be this same carousel of coaches that come in here, and some of them are, you know, have a mediocre time here, and others, there's always something going here. It's always, you know, there's always some kind of tumult that's happening during the season. And it just so happens that, you know, Jay Gruden ends and he walks out of there, you know, with 11 games left to play. So, you know, I don't know what that tells the fan base. I don't know how the fans, well, I know how they're reacting, but, you know, this fan base, man, I remember, you know, coming here as a rookie and a second year player, both back to back years in 2002 and 2003. And I just remember playing here in Washington as a New Orleans Saint. And I just remember vividly the fan base, man. They were riled up, you know. They were all dressed up and they were coming to the games in full force. And, you know, you don't see that anymore, man. It's, you know, it's 15 years later, and 16 years later, but you don't see that anymore. It's just now these are home games for the visiting teams, and the fans are disinterested in coming to the games and supporting this organization. So I don't know what, I know winning obviously cures all, but, you know, it just hasn't happened, man. And it sucks because the fans here, you know, it's a storied organization. They've had some success, you know, obviously with Joe Theismann and Riggins, you know, a lot of the guys, you know, Doug, it's the franchise has a storied program here, but it just hasn't happened. And the fans are really disinterested, man. And it's, you know, as a football fan and NFL fan, since as long as I can remember anything, you always remember that Washington was one of those teams where the fans were always into it. And it's just not like that anymore. And it's sad.
So what was it like there? Because it seemed like a bad scene. You know, it seemed like I had heard 75-80% Patriots fans. Did it feel like a low point for the franchise?
Yeah, you know, I knew going into the game just because you'd see it on TV, and this was the first game that I had been to this year, but you'd see it on TV, you know, whether if it was the Bears or, you know, whatever team came here, especially like it was the last four home games they've had, it's all been home games for the visiting team. And I told some guys that were coming down from the New England area, had a bunch of friends going to the game, and I told them, I said, you know, it's going to be a home game for the Patriots. I said, I expect it to be at least 60-40, and I think it was probably more than that at the game, 60-40 Pats fans. And you could see it, you could hear it throughout the stadium, and it was just a sea of blue among a few speckles of burgundy. And it is, like I said, it's a sad scene, man, because, you know, again, you feel bad for the fans here. And I live here. I live right in downtown, and people love this team, but it's just for them, it's hard to come out and support, you know, what's been happening here, you know, over the last, I don't know, the very long time here. The fans have not had much success outside of that 2012 season, and they made the playoffs in 2015 and had a first round exit. But, you know, I really hope they can get it together, because the fans here, I don't want to say they deserve a winner, but they deserve a winner.
How much is it systemic, you think? Because it's, I mean, like, and how much is this coming from, like, the Bruce Allen, Dan Snyder level? Because it does feel like they've had a lot of good coaches that have gone through there. They've had good players that have gone through there. And so you played there twice. Like, as a player, can you feel, like, some of the instability in the organization when you're there? Because you were in, I mean, look, Dante, you played for Andy Reid, you played for Sean Payton, you played for Bill Belichick, you played for John Harbaugh. So you saw what stability looks like. As a player, when you were there, could you feel the organizational instability at all?
You know what? You can. And it's just little things. It's just some of the little things that aren't taken as serious as in other organizations. And, you know, it's the way that these organizations are run. When you're talking about the Andy Reid years in Philadelphia, or when I played for Bill Belichick, and even John Harbaugh here in Baltimore, the stability from the time you walk into the door, you could feel it. You could feel the stability, and it shows on game day. It shows in the play, and as it does here with this team, you know, it shows on the play. When you walk into the organization, it just feels that way. And the sad part about it is that, you know, it's been like this for a very long time. So it gets to a point where, you know, it's like anyone in your life, if things aren't going well, you can't continue to blame others. You've got to start looking at yourself and seeing what you can do to best help your situation. And I don't think that they've had that recompense at all here in Washington.
You said the little things. Like, can you think of an example or two of, like, little things that were just different there than they were in other places you played?
Yeah, I mean, I think, for instance, like, and these are probably some of the things that people wouldn't ordinarily think about, but, I mean, food. You know, I know, and I know that after my first stint in 2011 here in Washington, the food kind of changed, but, you know, it's funny that, you know, you have, like, a lot of these guys or a lot of these players who are most of the players are making more money than, you know, 99% of the country. But, you know, if you want them to go out and perform, you've got to have a nutritionist. You know, you've got to have a person that looks at a guy and says, hey, man, you know, you probably shouldn't be piling cookies on that plate. Maybe do this, do that. You know, it sounds like it's right.
But it's important because it's like your body's your commodity in that.
It's so important. I mean, and not to veer off track, but I remember when I was in New England, I had a salad, and then I just put like two cookies on the side And I'm walking by, and Belichick looks at me, and he looks at my plate, and he just kind of smirks. He's like, two cookies, huh? It's like, it's good. It's like, good for you. And then I just, you know what I mean?
You didn't eat those cookies, did you?
You know what? I didn't. Actually only ate half one. But it's a reminder of, you know, it's important what you put in your body. And
yeah.
And we didn't have that, at least when I was in Washington. We didn't have that. And in every other place I've been, that's had organizational stability that shows on the field, we've had all those things. And so, you know, like I said, it's to me, when I look at the New England Patriots, you know, it starts from the top with Bob Kraft, you know, understanding that, you know, he's not necessarily a football guy. I'm not saying he doesn't know football, because he obviously does, but he understands that, okay, you know, I own this team. So
he gets that there are people that know more than he does.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. You know, he'll make some administrative decisions, but he leaves it up to Bill. And obviously Bill's got the experience and the history to back it up. But I think you have to, there's gotta be that time where, you know, you go and you look in the mirror and you see what's happening, and you have to look at yourself. And, you know, unfortunately for, you know, Dan Snyder and Bruce Allen, you know, to me, it starts with them, obviously.
Okay. So when you look at that staff that you played for then there, right. And I mean, it looks like an all-star team now. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like Mike Shanahan, Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay, Matt LaFleur. I think there are even some young up-and-coming guys like Shane Waldron who are there at the time, Mike McDaniel, that were there for all of that are really sharp guys. Like, do you ever think like how much like the whole operation was being held back, and like how great that might have been if just a couple things were different?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, because I remember thinking to myself, I had never, it reminded me of two things when I was there in 2011. It reminded me that I was getting old, because I was 31 at the time. And I was older than Kyle Shanahan, not by a lot, maybe a couple of months, but I was older than Kyle Shanahan, who was the offensive coordinator. I was older than Matt LaFleur. I was older than Sean McVay. And so it reminded me of two things. One, that I was getting old and my time in the league was coming to an end. But also that these young guys were, you know, were very bright. And I remember having multiple conversations, obviously with Kyle as the offensive coordinator, but even with Sean McVay. And I just remember thinking, like, where do you find this guy from? Like, seriously, like, where do you find this guy from? And he just, you know, he had a great football mind. And I knew that once he took over for offensive coordinator here, I knew that he would have some success. I didn't expect it to happen as fast.
Yeah.
But it just shows. And then, you know, I start thinking back to, you know, when we played the Patriots, actually, in 2011, the year they went to the Super Bowl and lost to the Giants in 2011.
Yep.
I remember thinking we beat the Giants twice that year, and we were playing the Patriots at home, and we were down to, I think, maybe 2 or 3 minutes in the fourth quarter, and we had a turnover inside our 10 or 15 yard line that we were going in to tie the game at the end of the game. And so, you know, that offense, man, we sputtered some, and we had quarterback changes, and it's hard to be a consistent, stable offense when you have multiple quarterback changes. But
there was promise there.
But, you know, when we were rolling, man, we were rolling, and we, you know, we were putting up points, you know, throwing the ball around the field, running the ball well. And, you know, it was disappointing, because I felt like we were much better than our record showed. But again, you know, it just comes to a point where, you know, you look at Bruce Allen, and I don't know Bruce Allen that well. I've spent a little time with him, and I think he's a good guy from what I can tell. But, you know, from his time there, his tenure, he's 42 and 75, I think, yeah. As you know, key executive there. So, you know, it eventually you've got to start, you know, looking at something, and maybe he should, I don't know, he could bring in someone like Louis Riddick and give him the reins, and just kind of step back and say, hey, this is your team. You do what you need to do.
Like he did with Scott McLuhan. A few years ago. And it actually like sort of worked in the short term.
It worked for them. Yeah, it worked. Got him in the playoffs.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, is there a coach that you think would be capable of coming in and fixing it? Like, if you could think, if they asked you, Dante, who should we bring in? Is there somebody that you think would be capable of managing his way through everything there?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably one of the biggest things that's going to maybe stop some coaches from going there, honestly. And obviously you may or may not want to give full autonomy to a younger, inexperienced coach. But you know what? I don't know. I don't know if any coaches are willing to. Somebody's obviously going to take the job, and right now it's Bill Callahan, who's been a head coach before in this league and in NCAA. But I don't know, man. I haven't even thought that far. It'll be interesting to see what they do at the end of the year. But I think it's going to take something like that for a coach to come in and say, hey, I want, you know, full top to bottom, you know, this, like, have him be able to hire his own staff, be able to hire everything from his position down and have, you know, full operational keys to be able to do those things. So hopefully it happens again. It's sad to see the fans moping around here every Monday morning after a Sunday game. And I'd like to see them have some success here. So I'm not really sure. Who do you have any?
I mean, I think they're going to take a hard look at Kevin O'Connell. Like I think that part of that is like some lingering regret on Sean having gotten out of the building and seeing some of the things. And look, he hasn't had the results that Sean's had yet, but I think seeing some of the traits that they saw in Sean early on that caused them to promote Sean and. Like Jay gave Sean play calling, was the only offensive coordinator he gave play calling to. And so I think like some of the people there in the building see some of the same traits in Sean and in Kevin that they saw in Sean. And maybe we can't let this guy go, but why would like a Lincoln Riley go there? You know what I mean? Like if you're a guy with options, like if you're Mike Tomlin, for example, right? I know his name's been floated. Like, would you, and I know that things aren't perfect with the Steelers right now. Who knows how much longer Ben's going to play. But if you're Mike Tomlin, do you stick with what you know? And I know he's from Virginia and everything else, but do you stick with what you know? And that's like a stable ownership, the most stable ownership you could hope for, like with an NFL team in the Rooneys.
Right.
Like a pretty good talent base, a good personnel department that's in sync with the coaches, like, if you're Mike Tomlin, why would you – I mean, unless they just blew you away or you badly wanted to get back home, like, why would you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it would take, honestly, Al. I think it would take for them to blow him away with an offer and for him to have, you know, some leanings to want to get back home. And I'm not sure if he grew up a fan of the team. I'm sure he did if he's living in the area, maybe. Although there are a lot of Cowboys fans here. But, you know, and that could be it. I think that's probably what it would take.
Sure.
And you see a lot of.
It's almost like they've got to pay a Snyder tax, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's what you would call it. exactly.
Okay, so two things off that conversation then that I want to I just kind of thought of, and it's going to be like the two polar opposites that you saw over your career: New England and Washington. What's the craziest thing you saw in Washington that's maybe indicative of the problem there?
You know what? So when I came back, in 2013, I just remember, you know, finally excited to have, an indoor practice facility, you know, and it gets really cold in Washington and it storms and there's some snow and, ideally you'd like to have an indoor practice facility. And I believe at the time, that Washington was the only team that did not have an indoor in the northeast corridor of the United States, I believe.
Right.
And again, obviously the indoors cost a lot of money. And I understand that, but you know, if you want some success, those are
helpful.
You know, things that are a part of the everyday the grind that you need to have.
They allow you to work.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I think also too, just being there. And again, it's kind of hard to describe, but you can just feel the instability. And maybe it's because, you know, again, I played with, you know, super organized, programs in Baltimore and Philadelphia and New England, but, you know, I try not to use the Patriots as the barometer for every other organization. But I mean, you know, they've been successful. So why not try to mimic that in some ways? And again, it's just like it's like when any player goes to New England, whether it's, you know, Antonio Brown, Randy Moss, or Corey Dillon, you feel that organizational stability. You feel the responsibility, the weight of being a Patriot. You feel the presence of Bill Belichick hovering around you like a friendly ghost, like when you're eating cookies, you know, and you probably shouldn't be, but there is that respect there. And again, when you're walking into a place like Washington, it's just not that same feel. And I know a lot of other veteran guys that have been on other teams, you know, feel that same way too with the organization.
All right. On the flip side of that, then, do you have a story that maybe illustrates why New England is New England? Whether it's something with Bill, something with Tom, something with Josh, can you think of an example of something that happened while you were there, something that happened with you personally that sort of illustrates why they are who they are?
I think there's a number of things, and I'll just briefly touch on a couple of things. Belichick doesn't come in the coach or in the players' locker room. That's their man cave, right? That's the players' man cave. And the only time he usually goes in there is to get to the training room, because he has to go through the locker room to get to the training room, or go to the weight room where he does his workouts every day. But, you know, I think that's one thing, and he respects the player's space. But at the same time, you know, he understands that, you know, the players have their space, but when you come to work, you know, it's all about work. He doesn't allow anything outside, and people would have, you know, people had issues with him not talking about the Antonio Brown thing, but I didn't expect him to do that. That's what he's done for as long as I can remember, and that's what he did when I was there, whether if it was Spygate or Deflategate or any other gate that they've had there. He's compartmentalized his team to not lament and languish on anything that the media wants to know. And again, whether if it's and now working in the media, I understand how that's problematic for a lot of journalists and the media themselves doing their job. But the way that Bill operates is that he doesn't allow anything outside to come into that. That doesn't have anything to do with playing that game that week. He won't allow that to seep into the locker room. And I think just having the team focus on not what the media stories are, not what the headlines are, but focus on winning that game. He has an unparalleled ability to do that. And I've never seen anything like it before, but obviously it's one of the things that works in their favor, and it helps those guys focus on teams that they're playing that week. Like, you know, we were playing the Dolphins, and they were 0-8. We were 8-0. And he made us believe that if we didn't go down there, they'd beat the hell out of us. And he didn't just say it and like yell at us. He actually showed us on film how they could beat us and what we needed to do to kind of neutralize their strengths and exploit their weaknesses. But he has the uncanny ability to dissect teams, and I've never seen anything like it. So, you know, for him, and obviously it takes a lot of hard work, right? You have
and everybody's
understand
always on
how a team works.
Everybody's always on their toes there too, like, do you ever like the pop quizzes, right? Like, I've heard about those.
Yeah.
Like, did you get those?
Oh God, yeah. And again, that's,
was there any weird one that like why'd he ask me that?
You know, he would ask the rookies about Memorial Day. He would ask them like, when is it and what does it mean? And you know, obviously he's a big military guy, so he would always like kind of rib the rookies and the younger guys. But I do remember one time, I don't remember the question, but he asked Rodney Harrison something, and you know, Rodney didn't know. So Rodney's like, you know, I don't know. And then he's like, oh, he's like, okay, good. He's like, that's a great way to show leadership, Rodney. You know, he's kind of said it jokingly and everybody laughed. But again, it doesn't matter who you are. He'll call on you and he expects you to, you know, to know these things. And again, it's these pop quizzes are meant to make sure that you're paying attention. Cause there are times where, you know, the weeks become monotonous, man. The NFL is a marathon, and the weeks become monotonous. And like any human, it's, you know, it's hard to stay focused on one thing 1,000% of the time. And so he just keeps guys on their toes. He'll say, hey, you know, we just put in third downs yesterday. And he'll ask, hey, Dante, what do they play? You know, what coverage are we expecting for them to play on 3rd and 8? And, you know, you better know it, because if you don't, then that means you're not paying attention. If you don't know what the team, we just implemented that in our game plan, game calling yesterday, and you don't know that coming in the next morning, he's going to think that you're not taking it serious. He's going to think you're not paying attention, and and he'll take that into account with your play time. And it's a serious structure over there, and it's not really meant to, you know, it's not really meant for people that are not used to having someone on you all the time. And yeah, you are right. People are walking on eggshells over there, but again, it's been successful for them for a very long time, and I don't see it changing. And you know, not too many people outside of that organization. I guess you don't know how if you're not in it, but
yeah.
They don't mimic it. And I wish more would in some regards.
All right, last thing for me then, because I'm sure you saw last night what the Niners did. It just looks. Am I wrong to look at what Kyle's doing and saying? Like, it almost feels like they've got a schematic advantage on everybody. Like, it almost feels like Kyle is almost – it's almost like he's bringing to the table – and Brian Hoyer said this to me once. He said Kyle is the offensive version of Bill Belichick. Like, just his ability to scheme, his vision for the game. Mm-hmm. Do you – like what sort of – like, when you watched that game last night – because you played for Kyle. You know, Kyle mm-hmm. was your play caller in 2011 – when you watched that, when you watched last night, what stuck out about the way the Niners played?
I think, I mean, it's just what you said, just the ability of Kyle to just, God, man, he has a great ability to be able to understand defenses and what they want to do to you, how they want to attack you. And he's able to call the right plays at the right time. And that's not an easy thing to do. You know, a lot of play callers, you know, get some things thrown at them that they may not be expecting, but it's, you know, it's his ability to be able to at the right moment, call the right play. And as someone who played in his offense, he was one of my favorite play callers. And obviously I'm biased. I'm a receiver. So he likes to run that 11 personnel a lot, you know, which is three wide receivers, one tight end, yeah, and one back. And, you know, he did that a lot last night. And some of the stuff that were staples in his offense is, you could see that last night. But it's been fun to watch him, man. It's been fun to see that team. And I grew up a 49ers fan, so I'm definitely excited to see what Kyle's done there. But it was fun playing in that offense, man, because he just had the ability, you know, whether if we made the play work or not, usually, you know, on third downs, you know, we were open. We just never – we just didn't always execute it, but, you know, the play was there. And I just remember always thinking that, like, you know, because sometimes, man, I'm telling you, I've been in some places where, you know, it's just like you're looking at the offensive coordinator like, man, what are you doing? Yeah. You know, I was never a vocal guy like that to, like, call out any coaches while I was playing there. But, you know, other guys didn't have problems with that. And it's frustrating, man. You know, you're going out and Belichick would always say, you know, players play and coaches coach. Our job is to put you in the best possible place to be successful. And your job is to run the plays, essentially to run the plays that we call. And he was like, sometimes we're not going to call the best plays and you guys got to make it work. Sometimes you guys aren't going to be playing well, but we've got to figure out a way to, you know, get that going. And so to know that Kyle has a great relationship with Belichick, I think it's probably helped, and I'm sure they've spent some time together. So yep, it's been fun to see what Kyle's done there. And again, obviously as a 49ers fan growing up, I've been excited for what they've been able to do. And obviously I like Kyle a lot. He's a good coach, and I've been excited to see what he's done there. And I hope they continue having that success.
Awesome. He's a CNN contributor, 11 years in the NFL, former first round pick. Dante, appreciate you coming out.
Albert, anytime, brother. Thanks for having me.
And we're back. We're going to dig into your questions now. Been doing it for a few weeks. Appreciate the response that we've gotten. There are two ways that you guys can get to us here on the pod. Number one, you can send your emails in to breermailbag@gmail.com. That's B-R-E-E-R, mailbag@gmail.com. Or we actually sort of would like you to take this option. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 201-596-4346. Again, you either email in at breermailbag@gmail.com or call in at 201-596-4346. And to get to all of those questions, we're going to go to our producer, Shelby. What we got?
This is from Sam. How concerned should the Patriots be with offensive output? The struggles seen in Buffalo were not isolated to that game and were seen after the first three drives against the Jets. Might they be able to trade for a wide receiver like Manny Sanders or even give up a first for Diggs?
All right, so let's start here. I think they'll figure it out. One way or another, they'll figure it out. I don't think that that means the quarterback shouldn't be frustrated, though, and I think he is frustrated. And I think you have to look at it from his perspective. Now, all of us on the outside, because we saw it in 2006, because we've seen it in other years, we've seen Brady make it work with a lot less, right? We've seen him make it work through injuries. We've seen him make it work through player attrition. But if you're that guy and you've always taken a little less money to make it work for the team, it would be frustrating if it was harder for you. It would be frustrating if they were hauling tackle after tackle out there after you lost your left tackle, who, again, dominated against Khalil Mack last week. That was Trent Brown. That would be frustrating if you're that player in that moment. So I can understand where Brady's frustrated. I do think that they'll wind up being fine because they're usually fine with Brady. The age is obviously a variable that's thrown in there that, you know, no one can predict when that's really going to hit him. We've seen it hit players in a hurry. But if all things stay the same, I think that they will figure it out because they've got a great coach in Josh McDaniels pushing the buttons and a great quarterback pulling the trigger. As far as trading for someone, I think they'd certainly be open to it. I think Stephon Diggs is going to be a little too rich for their blood. Emmanuel Sanders is one that could make sense, and it's almost like a Golden Tate type of option for them. They went in on Golden Tate last year. They offered a three for him. They didn't wind up getting him. He wound up going to the Eagles. So I think if you were willing to offer that for Emmanuel Sanders, it could make some sense to do it, especially because they're going to have extra third-round picks in the compensatory pick system this year after having lost Trent Brown and Trey Flowers. And so I think Emmanuel Sanders makes all the sense in the world. And we know for a fact that they like him because they signed him to an offer sheet all those years ago. Steelers wound up matching. He wound up in Denver the next year. But this is a player that they like, a player that would make some sense, and a player that I think could cost a little less than Stephon Diggs. Question two, Shelby.
From Sean, do you think A.J. Green will hold out for a new contract once he is 100% healthy? What week do you expect him to return?
I don't think he'll hold out, Shelby. I don't think that's the guy he is. You know, some guys have the stomach for it, other guys don't. I think A.J., my guess would be A.J., will be a good soldier whenever he comes back. I think you could see him be a little bit more cautious with it. When he gets to the point where he's close, I could certainly see where, all right, I got to be careful with myself now. The team's not playing very well. They obviously haven't won a game yet. He's a free agent after the year. I could see where he would be a little careful about coming back off of that. The Bengals are another team that I think is going to field some calls. It just hasn't been in their history to conduct any sort of fire sale. And so if I'm another team, do I call about Geno Atkins or Carlos Dunlap or Tyler Eifert or A.J. Green? Absolutely. I make that phone call. I don't think the Bengals are going to engage on those just because it's not their history to engage in those. They've obviously got an older owner. And I do think A.J. Green, I mean, he'd be an attractive, even at his age, even into his 30s, he'd be an attractive piece out there in the free agent market. My guess is the Bengals are going to do what they need to do to try to re-sign him. I wouldn't be shocked if he gets healthy, gets a couple games under his belt, and then maybe the Bengals move to do something, but I don't think he's going to hold out to force the issue. Question number three, Shelby.
From Jason, will the turmoil the NBA found itself in with the Chinese market, does the NFL have aspirations to enter other international markets other than London and Western Europe?
Good question. So I think right now the focus, and I talked to Chris Halpin, one of the executives of the league who's in charge of international, he's in charge of gambling. And you know, he said to me that the focus right now is obviously on London and continuing to build there. And they're going to take the London template, probably other places. They've obviously done it in Mexico City already. The two countries that he mentioned to me as the next frontiers were Canada, where they've already been, and Germany. And Germany is a place where, you know, not only is it popular from a viewer perspective, they've actually produced players. And so Germany, to me, would be the next one. I think if they do put a game there, it'll either be in Munich or Hamburg. Ultimately, I do think that they view China as an important frontier, and I think they do eventually want to go there. They've got some interest in Australia. They've got some interest in Brazil. But as we've seen, it takes time for them to actually put games in these places. And in places where the NFL is already popular, they've been hesitant to put games there. And I think that was as much about getting the right formula in London as they possibly could, and then using that formula and applying it in other places and having like a singular focus on these places. And so I think Germany is next. They go outside of Western Europe eventually, but it'll be a while. Question number four, Shelby.
Hey, Albert. I wanted to talk about new quarterbacks and young quarterbacks in the NFL. You see Gardner Minshew, who's a sixth-round pick that's thriving with the Jags. Kyle Allen's undrafted for the Panthers that's playing well. Mason Rudolph was a third-round pick for the Steelers, who's seemingly taking over the franchise. Do you think teams are going to reevaluate the way they draft quarterbacks, considering there's continued success of quarterbacks that have been either undrafted or drafted in later rounds? So do you think that quarterback development is more important in today's game than it's ever been before?
Okay, good question. Again, a reminder, guys, when you call in, I can refer to you by name if you give me your name, but I appreciate the question anyway. I think the mistake sometimes people make, because the quarterback position is so important, they ignore how dependent the quarterback is and everybody around them. And so much of becoming a great quarterback, I think, depends on the environment that you're pushed into. And there is a chicken and egg thing going. There's a chicken and egg argument to be made there with guys like Brady, guys like Rodgers, guys like Manning. But if you look at those guys, what do those guys have coming in? All right. Peyton Manning, I believe, had Tariq Glenn as a franchise left tackle. Peyton Manning had Tom Moore calling the plays for him. I mean, really, for the first 14 years of his career. Peyton Manning had Marvin Harrison with him. Peyton Manning had a lot of good things environmentally. Tom Brady went from Charlie Weiss to Josh McDaniels to Bill O'Brien back to Josh McDaniels, all one system. When he came into the league, he was being managed. They had a very good defense. They weren't leaning too much on him. He was a game manager at the beginning. There's no other way to explain what he was. And he wound up, the Patriots wound up finding his franchise left tackle in the same draft class, or in the draft class before he actually started playing in 2001. That was Matt Light. So a lot of good things environmentally. Same thing with Aaron Rodgers. Yeah, he went through a firing after his rookie year, but he wasn't even playing yet when they fired Mike Sherman. By the time he was playing, Mike McCarthy was the head coach. He and Mike McCarthy came up together, played in the same system, learned in the same system, get to see everything through the same sort of lens early in your career, had good players around him, guys like Chad Clifton, guys like Greg Jennings early in his career. So I think so much of making it work from a quarterbacking standpoint, even Russell Wilson in Seattle, like that was a fully that was a program that was ready to break through by the time Russell Wilson got there. Russell Wilson gets there in 2012. John Schneider and Pete Carroll had already been building for 2 years. You had Russell Okung, you had Richard Sherman, you had Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas, and Bobby Wagner came in with him. I mean, you had Marshawn Lynch. You had so many pieces there already, and so I think your question is a good one. I think you have to look at the situation these quarterbacks are coming into. The Jaguars don't need to ask the world of Gardner Minshew. The Steelers don't need to ask the world of Mason Rudolph. So I think so much of that is dependent on environment and how much you're asking of these guys right away. Eventually you want them to grow, a franchise guy. You want them to grow into somebody who can carry a team, who can make up for losing a guy in free agency or make up for someone getting hurt. But it doesn't work that way right away. And I think the support system that a quarterback walks into is vital, which is why Dwayne Haskins is in a tough spot right now. He just went through his first coach firing a month into his first year. Trent Williams is holding out. The receiver situation, I mean, his number one receiver is a guy who may not have been his number one receiver at Ohio State last year. Josh Rosen, maybe two of the worst situations you could possibly be in. Going to Arizona last year and then Miami this year. They traded their left tackle right before the year. So I think so much of quarterback development is environmental. And I think that sometimes we make that mistake because the quarterback is so important. We don't look at how important everybody else is to the quarterback. While the quarterback's the most important piece of the team, the quarterback's also as dependent on the other 10 guys in the huddle, maybe more so than any other player. Shelby, question number five.
Hey, Albert, it's Sam in Texas. Watching that Cowboys-Saints game on Sunday, I know that Zeke struggled, but in the previous week, Kellen Moore's system seemed to be running through Dak a lot. And given that and how much emphasis they're
you know, running the offense through Dak. I was wondering if you think that down the line the Cowboys are going to regret, you know, giving Zeke that much money and putting such a focus on him if, in fact, they are going to, you know, look to Dak to run through that offense. Thank you.
Sam, I appreciate the question. I would say I do not think that they're going to regret giving the money to Zeke because it's spread out in a way, because they did it too early, two years early, where, I mean, you're basically the new money average, the number that matters to the player is $14 million per, but the new money, but the total, when you spread it out, I believe is around $12 million per. And so over the next 4 years, it's a manageable number for a high-end skill player. It's a lot less than you'd be paying for a high-end receiver, without question, and you're going to be getting this sort of production out of the guy, provided he stays healthy, where it's going to look like a bargain in the long term. Here's the other thing. So much of what Kellen Moore is doing and putting in for Dak Prescott is based off play action. And Kellen Moore is running a different system than a McVay or a Kyle Shanahan, but one of the guiding principles is exactly the same. That's marrying the run game to the passing game. That's making certain plays look alike that are run plays to pass plays and pass plays to run plays. So it's making it easy on the quarterback and making it hard on the defense. It's dressing it up. So you're getting your players playing fast and you're putting the defensive players in conflict and getting them playing slower. And so it's for Dak, I think, he's always played in these sorts of offenses because he played in an option offense in college at Mississippi State. And I think this is an effort to get him playing faster. And if that run game's working, it puts teeth in all of that. It puts teeth in the idea of marrying the run game to the pass game. It puts teeth into the play action. And we saw that early in the year. I have faith that Kellen Moore is going to be able to figure this out. And I think Zeke Elliott will continue to be a vital piece to what they're doing down there in Dallas. All right. Appreciate you guys coming out. As always, we want your feedback. I think this is the fifth edition of the new podcast, I believe, right, Shelby? We're five down. I'm having a blast with it. Love bringing on different guys every week. It's been fun doing that. And I love the interaction with you guys, both in the mailbag and any sort of interaction you guys can give us, any sort of feedback you can give us on what we can do better. We're still early in the year. I'm willing to apply whatever you guys think to make this thing better so you guys can enjoy it on your commute, so you guys can enjoy it during your lunch break, whenever you're listening to it. So if you want to get to me, you can get to me on my Twitter page, at Albert Breer, on my Facebook page, at Albert R. Breer, on my Instagram page, at Albert_Breer. And remember to always listen to all the MMQB podcasts. You can get all of us on one feed right now. That's MMQB NFL Podcasts. And if you want the bite-sized news podcasts, and I do a couple of those a week as well, you can get those. That's a separate feed, the MMQB news feed. And so we've got the news feed. We've got the longer form podcast feed. Subscribe to both. You can get them on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. We're there. Same time next week. I'll be there. I'll see you guys then.